Good evening. Thank you for joining us for another week of Catch the Flavor Youth Radio here on Radio Regent. I'm your host for tonight, Diamond. Choosing the profession of teaching is a choice many make. Whether fueled by their passion to work with children or by their love for a specific subject, having the chance to become an inspirational figure for a generation is truly gratifying, isn't it? Now imagine the added bonus of experience and culture and language different from your own. Specifically, the cultures and languages of Nunavut. For our guest today has done just that. Joined with us today is Marcia, an elementary teacher in Nunavut. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So can you tell us a little about what you did in Nunavut?
Well, I am an elementary school teacher, and this is my, September is going to be my third year, and so far, I taught grade 6 my first year, 2015-16, mm-hmm. and 16-17, I was given the opportunity to work as a student support teacher, in which I am responsible, because mm-hmm. this job is also continuing on to the next school year, given the responsibility to work with all students mm-hmm. and teachers, so mm-hmm. I'm a part of administration.
Nice. So how did the opportunity of teaching in Nunavut arise?
Well, as an immigrant, I came in and there was no opening in teaching. Mm-hmm. So I went to the University of Toronto. I did a master's degree in psychology and still no work.
Yeah.
So I have friends who have been in the North before mm-hmm. and they encouraged me, you know, to give it a try. And of course, I did, and there's no regret.
Mm. That's wonderful. So how long did you teach in Nunavut, and what was your drive to stay there?
So far, I've gone 2 years, and my drive to stay there is that I can show my full potential as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
It is really gratifying to work there because you can see your work, not that you can see it elsewhere, but there you definitely, because the level of education is below the expected standard mm-hmm. across Canada. And so as a teacher who has been trained outside of Canada, I do know what it is to raise the level of teaching and the level of learning for my students, and that I can bring out there.
Mm-hmm. So you said you came and you got university, you know, but were you also studying in the country before you came to Canada? Were you a teacher?
Yes, I taught for 10 years in Jamaica.
Oh.
So I went to St. Joseph's Teachers College mm-hmm. and I also went to Northern Caribbean University mm-hmm. where I did my undergraduate degree.
So would you say that 10 years of experience kind of helped you?
Oh, definitely. It's you're being molded there, mm-hmm. so it's not a struggle to really come out here and do what you know is right in teaching.
So why did you decide to teach in Nunavut over other places? Was this like an immediate, you know, opportunity, or were you looking for somewhere else and then?
No. My reason for really going to Nunavut, the community that I'm now working in, I read about this community when I was in grade 3.
Oh, wow.
And I always wanted to see the midnight sun, and I wanted to see an igloo. And that I've seen how they build the igloo.
Yeah.
And I've seen the 24-hour sunlight and also the 24-hour darkness.
That must be just amazing.
It is amazing.
So what qualifications might a person need to teach in Nunavut or the other territories?
Well, teaching in Nunavut is just like teaching anywhere else in Canada. Mm-hmm. You need to be a certified teacher.
Yeah.
And with that, you have your teaching license. And once you have that, along with a vulnerable sector check and a criminal record check, you can apply for a job, you'll be interviewed, and if you do well with your interview, of course, you'll be offered a position.
Mm-hmm. So how was that experience with you? How did you feel going into Nunavut? Any expectations, what you think they perceive of you? What was your worries?
Well, going to Nunavut was exciting. I wanted to go there. you know, in my initial stage. So my planning was, you know, up to scratch. Mm-hmm. Everything was in place. And going there, my fears were that, one, as a black person, how would they accept me? Mm-hmm. Whether or not they think I would be able to communicate with them.
Yeah.
And secondly, because there's also the language barrier. So, mm-hmm. because I've taught elsewhere and some students complain that, oh, we don't speak English. And so, but if you're learning English, then you have to listen to mm-hmm. English speakers. So yeah. that was kind of an issue for me. But being mm-hmm. there, no problem.
So what did you do as a teacher in an event? Were you an English teacher or were you doing something else?
I was an elementary teacher. I taught grade 6. Mm-hmm. And for my first year, I was offered a position in admin based mm-hmm. on the work I've done. My principal walked into my classroom and he said, based on what I've seen, read the turnaround of the students and their behavior and the respect and the discipline mm-hmm. that I set in my class, he wants me to work in the office as a student support teacher where I will work with the students that are on plans yeah. and also the overall behavioral aspect of the school to really shape it and bring it around. So that's a great offer, and I took it. And so far, I've done extremely well based on the comments that I've had from other teachers and mm-hmm. staff, and they wanted me to do it again, second year.
So how do you think your experience would kind of differ from someone that's teaching in South Canada?
You have to go with an open mind. Mm. You cannot bring your preconceptions with you. Mm-hmm. Be open to learn, to read, to adopt to the culture, and just want to know more. Mm-hmm. And be willing to apply your skills as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And once you're willing to do that, and covers all, you have to love the children.
Yes.
You don't have that, you're going to get nowhere.
Mm-hmm. So were there any clashing views or perspectives of the students or teachers or even staff at the school compared to your own that made you teaching and working with them kind of difficult?
At first, I had one student who wanted to challenge me. And I took him aside mm-hmm. and I explained to him that I've been hired by the government to teach you. Mm-hmm. And that's something you have to respect. You don't have a choice. So get inside and start your work. Mm-hmm. And having that conversation with the student, I realized it covers everything. No one else wanted to adopt his style. Regarding the teachers, I've created a platform where respect is the order of the day. So I give respect and they give me mm-hmm. back respect. So we were all on the same page.
How did the parents think of you? Like, how did they react to you?
I had one or two parents who wanted their kids to be removed from my class very first day. And one was given the opportunity to have her daughter removed from the class. Mm-hmm. The others were not.
Yeah.
And after a while, the one that was removed wanted to come back. So after seeing my work and the relationship with the students, not everyone wants to be in my class. Mm-hmm. And so the parents, all good. I have a good turnout for my parent interview nights. Mm-hmm. Everyone, almost everyone showed up. And those who didn't come, they sent a letter or a message to let me know that they weren't able to make it, but they will come in and see me other times. So that's a great improvement and everyone appreciated it.
So what misconceptions of Nunavut or other Northern Canada or Northern Canada in general do you think is portrayed but differ with your experience? So like, what do you think people's ideals based on what they're told by the media would be different of what you've seen?
First, the idea of poverty. Mm. Poverty is everywhere.
Yeah.
And the people there, I see, yes, there's poverty, but not to the extreme that we see on the media.
Yes.
Or in the media. So That is one. Another is the education standard. The kids, they won't learn or they won't go to school. But if you motivate them, they're mm-hmm. just like any other children anywhere else in the world. They want to learn. They're willing to learn. They can learn. So the stereotype of them, you know, not wanting to be in school and not wanting to learn or not, that can go through the window.
Yeah.
Right.
So how do you tackle those certain students that feel that they can't learn just because of what society thinks of them, and you being, and I don't want to say an outsider, but somebody they're not used to telling them that?
Well, as a guidance counselor myself, I know how to really pull them aside and have that one-on-one conversation with mm-hmm. them. Also, I meet with the parents very regularly mm-hmm. just to explain to them the purpose of them, their kids being in school, and also their involvement. Parental involvement is extremely important. Mm-hmm. So I try to build that relationship with the parents.
Yeah.
And once I have that with the parents, then the kids come in. So I have relationship with the parents, relationship with the students, and that is what covers everything. So they will come to school. I have one parent who said her son would not have breakfast in the morning at mm-hmm. home because he doesn't want to be late for school, which never happened before.
Yeah.
So that's an achievement.
So you said you also were a guidance counselor, right? Was that when you got there, or did you have training before? Did you do that in Jamaica as well?
No, I did it here in Canada. Well, I can't do guidance counseling in Nunavut because of the language.
Yes.
So they speak in Inuktitut. So you would have to have someone to interpret when you're doing your consultation.
Yeah.
So the school has its own guidance counselor, but we work together.
Mm-hmm.
So I can use my guidance counseling skills to influence the students and parents to get what I want done.
Yeah. So outside of teaching, because we all know there's teaching and you also have those extracurricular times outside of teaching, how did you enjoy Nunavut? What did you did? How was the language barrier? How did you get about?
Well, I asked my students to teach me, so
yeah.
it was like fun because they were my teachers outside of my regular teaching hours.
Yeah.
So they take it for fun to teach me the words, and then they'll say, you need to say it this way, or you need to pronounce it this way, and so. So that's fun time. They have lots of activities around town and table sales, community games. Lots of activities. So you just have to be a part of the winter and get yourself involved with the activities because a lot of the activities are outdoors.
Yeah. So how was that? Like, what kind of activities did you do?
They play Inuit games.
Yeah.
So we learn how to throw the stick with the bone on it and to catch bone back on it and so on. There's one, it's more of a wrestling with the shoulders. Mm-hmm. And so you watch them do that. They have what is called the hooky dance. So they put their arms around each other and they dance and so on. And they have the square dancing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really good. They play a lot of hockey games, teams against each other in the community and outside. So there are lots of things going on. So you just get involved. You just look at the posters that are around town and you get yourself involved.
So being a woman of color and going up north, do you think you connected with the kids, your students, on a certain level? Was there any clash?
No. Reason being, I let them know that even though your culture originated in the north, mine is similar.
Yeah.
And so we share a lot of things together. So we talked a lot about the similarities and the difference we are cultures, so that kind of bridged the gap between us.
Were they ever interested in your stories? Especially?
They wanted to hear the stories like every day, and I want to hear their stories. And when I went home, I took pictures of like donkeys and goats because we have a farm, so I have lots of farm animals on it. So I showed it them, and they were like, you have those at home? Can we go see them? And they were like, really happy. I showed them the orange tree, the oranges on the trees and the coconuts. So lots of fruits, because they don't understand that the carrots don't just appear in the supermarket. They have to be grown, and they have to be harvested and shipped to them. So when I show them how it's been planted, then they see totally differently. Oranges, they're on trees. The pineapples, they're, you know, very close to the earth before you can pick them. So then they get it.
So how is, what's the difference between teaching Jamaica and teaching in Nunavut? Do you, would you say encourage other teachers to go study, to go teach abroad, and what experiences and, you know, things they can learn by doing that?
There's a big difference with the teaching in Nunavut and teaching in Jamaica, because the standards are different. In Jamaica, there's total discipline regarding being in school. How do you speak to your teacher? What do you do? You get your homework done. You have to be in line and so on. But there you have to guide them and let them know what are the expectations. So there's a challenge in teaching there in terms of shaping them the way you want them so that they can achieve their goals. As against in Jamaica, you do that, but at a lesser extent, because it's already engraved in
them. So how did you tackle feeling homesick? Was there any, like, things you did just to feel, you know, that sense of home? Did you bring anything with you in case you would?
Yes, we have our little groups, our Afrocentric groups. So there are other colored people around. So we meet ever so often, and we have our dinners together and so on. And I read a lot of books, watch movies, of course, African movies and so on. And I study. I'm always studying. So I do have something on my hands going on all the time.
So what would you say is your biggest gain from teaching Nunavut?
My biggest gain is just to see the students move from one level to the next in terms of their learning, in terms of their maturity, and in terms of their behavior, because behavior is a big issue. And some teachers can't handle that. And when I see that, I can see kids in the hallway and they'll just explain, oh, I'm just going to the washroom, or I'm just going to have some water. Then that's a big achievement.
So what would you recommend, some sort of teaching exchange, just as there is student exchange? Would you recommend like a program for that for teachers?
I would, because there's growth there in the in the teaching profession, and just to get the experience, because a lot of times they ask for Canadian experience. So you don't have the Canadian experience, then go to the north and work and get that Canadian experience, and it's something that you will never forget.
So you said you're not a guidance counselor, but you were assisted with the teachers, right?
So I'm a student support teacher.
So how does that go?
Well, as a student support teacher, I work with the students that are special needs right across from kindergarten to grade 7. And with these students, I have to check in with the teachers to make sure that they're giving them the right work to do. They're measuring, marking, and assessing using the right tools for those kids. And also those who are not on plans, they are also giving them the work that they're supposed to get and not the work that the students who are on plans are getting, because some people will make it short and give everybody the same thing. So I have to make sure I check in to see what is going on with the group that's not on plan and the group that is on plan for every class, every teacher.
Were there any teachers that you find were kind of negative, with had negative experiences, or were going about teaching in a new environment a negative way that you had to deal with?
Yes, I have had that experience, but based on my studies in psychology again. I draw back on my learning there. Mm-hmm. So I was able to approach it in a very positive way, mm-hmm. and, you know, create an environment that those teachers can come in and feel free to talk with me, and I can talk with them and help them along the way, and also encourage them, because most of them are young teachers. So, you know, I let them know about my experience, so mm-hmm. they can use me as a resource person to help them through.
So was teaching your first, was that your dream? Did you really want to do teaching?
No, I wanted to be a nurse. But when I got into teacher's college, I got accepted to nursing school after.
Yeah.
And then I went to the principal, Catholic sister, nun. So yeah. I went to her and she said, no, you're staying. You're not going anywhere. I want you to be a teacher and you're not going anywhere. You're going to stay. So mm-hmm. she didn't give me a refund. And so I just had to stay in college.
So what was your most negative and most positive experience in Nineveh?
The most positive experience is that my students are really learning, mm-hmm. and I can see the change. And I create the environment, along with the help of other teachers, of mm-hmm. course, to give them a positive view on life, to let them know that there's so much more to life than mm-hmm. just sitting and looking around doing nothing. Mm-hmm. So that's the positive, where they want to go to university, they want to go to college, they want to finish school and so forth, and not having babies before time and mm-hmm. so on. So that's a good positive for me. The negative is that I would love to see 100% attendance.
Yeah.
But I'm not there yet. I'm getting close.
So as a teacher that would go abroad or to Nineveh, what qualities do you think they should have to have a positive experience just like you?
You must have patience mm-hmm. and love and a willingness to go an extra mile. Mm-hmm. Once you are able to do that, you're good.
So do you have anything else you wanted to add?
Just to let the other teachers who are unemployed and still looking around to know mm-hmm. that they can look on the outside too for a job, and it is not as cold as is. Just come and experience it. You dress warm and you will be fine. Mm-hmm.
So that's all we have the time for. We have for the first of our show. We would like to thank our guest, Marcia. Thank you very much for sharing her insightful experience on teaching in Nineveh. Stay tuned, because coming up after our musical break, we will be talking about Toronto-based graphic novelist Sarah Finn and her webcomic influenced by her experience with the mental health system. You don't want to miss it. Welcome back to Catch the Flavor Youth Radio here on Radio Regent with your host, Diamond. If you're just joining us, we just wrapped up our first half on the teaching and living experience in Nineveh. Often individuals with mental and emotional challenges not only combat the symptoms and difficulties that may result from these challenges, but sadly are often bombarded by the social stigma and stereotypes society has created. Such misconceptions surface and spread and fuel the prejudice, which can make anyone, let alone those who suffer from psychiatric disorders, to feel isolated, victimized, and stressed. Toronto-based graphic novelist Sarah Finn is a writer, illustrator, cartoonist, and self-identified mad person. Described as superheroes who pop pills, her webcomic Asylum Squad is a creative work influenced by her experience at Camp H. Joining us today is creator of Asylum Squad, Sarah Finn. Welcome.
Hello.
So can you tell us, and the viewers that haven't heard of Asylum Squad, can you tell us a little bit about what it's about?
Well, basically, it's a sort of kind of slightly satirical take on the psychiatric system. Mm-hmm. It sort of like talks back to psychiatric labeling and psychiatric abuse. It is mad pride in the sense that it is speaking for the bad public, mm-hmm. and I, as a mad person, I don't actually identify with having a mental illness. Mm-hmm. I identify as having a spiritual crisis that I'm actually sorting through at this point. I've actually been undiagnosed, so I truly believe I'll be leaving the system one day, and it's just it gives a voice to people who have been there, and also it's for people who work in the system who get what it's like, you know, to be mm-hmm. on the other side and are frustrated by it.
It's wonderful to have that mentality of, like, you're going to come out soon, because I know a lot of people have that feeling that they'll never get out just by what, you know, their doctors have been telling them and nurses and everybody. So it's wonderful that you have that mentality.
Yeah.
So why did you decide to create Asylum Squab into a webcomic and share it with the world?
Well, the original version was kind of a prototype, which I'm not particularly fond of, because I was creating it back when I was just experimenting with comics, and that's when I wasn't really aware of what I wanted to say. And it's when I was dealing with more sort of teenage angst kind of issues and taking antidepressants for it. And then when I had my crisis, I ended up in the system even more deep than I was initially, and that's when I eventually ended up in CAMH for a year, and then I decided to revamp what I had worked on before, because there were two versions I had tried to work on before, and the third version is the one that you know on the web, and that version, the version that I first put up in CAMH, it doesn't exist on the web anymore. It's the psychosisdiaries.com, which is gone. And the reason I took it down is because I don't really identify with the work anymore. I feel it was a stage that I kind of had to go through. But the work on asylumsquad.ca is what followed, and that's what remains.
Yeah. So is there a specific reason why you wanted to make it a webcomic? Is there a tenant audience you really wanted to reach out to?
Well, I want to make it a webcomic because I believe that webcomics are an excellent way, not necessarily an excellent way of making money all the time, but they're an excellent way of reaching a broader audience. And then if people like the work, then they may buy the book. And I do self-publish graphic novels.
So Asylum Squad was influenced by experience with the Toronto health system. Could you share what you experienced in CAMH and what led you there, if you feel comfortable?
I don't feel comfortable talking about what led me there, although I will say that I did cross I did cross some lines. I got into a little bit of trouble. And that's when that happens, they tend to keep you there for a while. I also lost my housing, and that's another reason. And my experiences were pretty dire in the system, especially during that time. I mean, I went through everything from community treatment orders to restraints to seclusion cells to being told I'd never get better and that I had a pathological disease and all this crap. Like, basically, it was what I call brainwashing. Yeah. And I was like, I knew deep down that my problem was more on the spiritual spectrum of disorder rather than a chemical flaw, simply because of I just knew. I can't even really explain it at this point. I knew, and now I actually have a Jungian analyst and a psychiatrist, actually, who agree with me. So that's really supportive.
Yeah. So how did the creation process for Asylum Squad help you cope with your experience in CAMH?
So what it was is it was my way of sort of like expressing myself, just because often enough in these institutions, it's long-term care institutions, it's hard to really express yourself and be heard and understood for fear if you're too emotional, you could be punished for it. So if I put it in art, it really wasn't really going to get me in trouble. And it was my way of voicing myself on the internet with what I was dealing with, in a way that was constructive and in a way cathartic.
So were there any challenges while writing Asylum Squad? Were there times when you had like a sense of writer's block and how you came through that?
I do have writer's block from time to time, and actually I'm kind of on summer vacation from it right now. If anybody's listening and they read my comic, I do have a tendency to go on to mini hiatuses once in a while, and it's because I have to focus on my spirit, and I have to focus on my social life, and I have to focus on myself. And and then usually what happens is I get like super, super, what I call art horny, and then I come back to it, and then I gotta create. So then I crank out the pages. Right now I'm just sort of on a bit of a hiatus. It's not an official hiatus, it's more of a just sort of like a slow to update kind of state. Yeah.
See, I was wondering, because I actually read your comics, so I was just like, when is Liz going to open that door?
Yeah, no, don't worry. That page will probably be up in a week.
Oh, so nice.
And then the next page, I haven't, like I said, summertime is like the worst time for me creatively, and it's because I'm so busy enjoying the sunshine, and I just want to do other things. And then by the fall, that's when I get back into gear again.
But sometimes a great time just to get influence, you know?
Yeah, it's a good time to I need to reflect sometimes, and I need to sort of think, is based on the script, is this how I want to proceed with the story? And then what I do is I take away from my downtime what I've concocted, and mm-hmm. then I apply it. So right now I'm just sort of thinking, what's the next move? Do I like the script? Like, I have the script all plotted out, and I just want to make sure that I nail it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So are there any other plans to expand the scope of Asylum Squad than just a comic? Because I know you have, or there's a video game out there, and it's just
Yeah, there's a video game. Unfortunately, I don't think the Macintosh version is working right now, mm-hmm. at least from the download page. But there is like a demo video game. The PC version, I think, works. I've announced prior, so I can say it here, that I am kind of working with a television director to adapt it to make a short film based mm-hmm. on the backstories of Liz Matter. We're still trying to do budgeting stuff, so mm-hmm. I have no idea when this film would come out. It's not been abandoned or anything. I announced this years ago, yeah. but it's just a money issue. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of people on board. It comes down to the Benjamins, really. That's the only real reason it has taken a while to move forward. And as far as anything else goes, I guess the future will tell.
Mm-hmm. So what do you hope people will gain from reading Asylum Squad? Do you think your webcomic will help shatter some of the misconceptions associated with people that identify as mad?
I think that it's I hope that people who read it, it shatters misconceptions of madness, and it also shatters the idea that we can easily be labeled and boxed into these mm-hmm. diagnoses, which really aren't that scientific, to be quite honest. Like the way that when I was I've been diagnosed with so many different things before being undiagnosed. I was told I had schizophrenia, schizoaffective. Basically, you really just have to be seen as crazy to be diagnosed as that. Mm-hmm. They don't really have any tests to prove that your brain actually is malfunctioning, but they need to give you a diagnosis to prescribe, so they have to call it something. Mm-hmm. So they call it that. The unfortunate part of that is that the label can carry around in your psyche, and it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy, almost like a nocebo effect, kind mm-hmm. of like opposite of placebo.
Yeah.
So that's what I refused to allow happen. So I just kept saying, no, that's not what I have, because I knew I didn't have it. Like, I'm not going to talk about whether or not schizophrenia is real or not or anything like that, because yeah. people do have these experiences. Mm-hmm. And there's a debate about whether or not the label even is a legitimate something that is physical, right? Mm-hmm. It's a construct. But I know that my own experiences have gone. Some of my so-called symptoms are not even in the DSM. Mm-hmm. And I barely have any symptoms of schizophrenia anyway.
Yeah.
So people hear voices for different reasons. It's not mm-hmm. just because of a brain imbalance. Maybe your ancestors are talking to you. Maybe your higher self is talking to you. Maybe something about your psyche is trying to tell you something. This is the new branch of psychology that's opening up. Mm-hmm. And this is the new perspective on voice hearing. So that's another element that I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. So what have you personally done other than what have, you know, like your psychologist been telling you to do just to tackle the way you're feeling?
What do I do for
yeah,
self-care?
Yeah.
Okay. I do a lot of spiritual work with myself. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of praying, meditating, contemplating, you know, self-reflection. I try to exercise and eat well, or at least eat better than I used to. I try to have fun. I don't work too hard. I try to be positive. You know, general kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how has Asylum Squad grew from when you first started it to now?
Well, the original version was kind of silly. That's the one that I did back just mm-hmm. after high school. And it was sort of like a few issues that were put out. It wasn't very Mad Pride. It was actually almost sort of ableist because I really didn't get it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second version, which came out, but it actually didn't come out. It was just I was working on it, and it was supposed to be published, but it never was. It's sort of I proved on my skills, and I was trying to sort of tell the same old story, but it still wasn't there. And then after I got it, mm-hmm. like after I really got the system and got what it was like to yeah. go mad and stuff, I said, okay, I still want to work with these characters. I still want to work with this title, but I have to take from what I learn and apply it now properly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the difference. It's a more that has something to say now,
yeah.
as opposed to in the past, it was just silliness.
So how did you get involved with Toronto Mad Pride?
The initial Mad Pride that I was involved with, I never lived in Vancouver, but I was invited out by a friend to Vancouver Mad Pride back in 2006, and that was the first time I'd ever heard of it. Mm-hmm. And she and I partook in some activities at Gallery Gachet, which is a gallery near Hastings Street.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened was when I was back in Toronto after that, it was like that was the last summer of sanity, or I say that in quotations, before I actually ended up going, well, mad. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up becoming involved with Toronto Mad Pride after my stay at CAMH, after I put out the comic. And I ended up joining the Mad Pride committee a couple of times. I keep meaning to join it again, but I haven't gotten back to it just simply because of activities I've been busy with and stuff like that. It all depends on how my year is going, how much I have going on, so or where I am mentally, mm-hmm. right?
So what are some of the things you believe the government could invest in that would improve the mental health system?
The first thing I always talk about in relation to that is I think housing is one of the most important things that the government needs to really put money into. Like, we have ballots talk, but the money always seems to go to CAMH and stuff like that. And we need to really start putting that money towards housing because that's a fundamental need for mental health, is mm-hmm. good housing. I think we need to put more money into more psychotherapy and less pharmaceutical care mm-hmm. because most people, I think, who have mental health challenges, they really should try just – dealing with their problems. They really just need somebody to talk to, at least for I'm not anti-medication, but I think for lots of people, psychotherapy, maybe sometimes a combination of both psychotherapy and medication is good, or maybe they just need psychotherapy, mm-hmm. but never just medication. Medication is a band-aid, and that's all it can ever be.
Mm-hmm. With saying that, are there some things that you're grateful that the health system has gave you access to?
You know what? I had to really just find it on my own. I don't feel that – I mean, the meds sort of – they take the edge off my experiences so that I can do what I do. But I wouldn't say they're much more than that. There's some of like Novocaine. And, but my union analyst, I actually have to pay for him. Mm-hmm. And the psychiatrist I found her randomly. And mm-hmm. she is like amazing. She is nothing like any I've ever seen. Yeah. She actually – When I talked to her, I feel like I'm talking to a guru. Like, that's how cool it is. So, I can't really say that the system, as far as the more structured system that I've been through, has really done me much good. I'm sure it's helped many people, but for me, I had to navigate and find my own way mm-hmm. with other avenues.
So has there been any backlash of you uploading, sharing Asylum Squad, any negativity?
There's been mild comments here and there on the web that I've come across when I Googled it, but you know what? Not really. It's just people who don't get my sense of humor, mm-hmm. or they don't get, you know, something that I've said, and they don't understand where I've been and why I said it necessarily. And mm-hmm. it's not really, I mean, I just sort of have to sort of accept that you're not going to please everybody, right? So I just sort of – I'm trying to grow a thicker skin and deal with it in a way that doesn't get me, you know, anxious for putting stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So do you see Asylum Squad growing in the future? Is there any level to it? Do you hope it will –
I'm actually wrapping up the series by next year. Mm-hmm. There is going to be a cap-off point. And then, I don't know, maybe someday I'll do a spinoff. Who the hell knows? But at this point, I'm sort of done with the subject of mental health. I want to move on to other subjects. I'm not even sure entirely what it'd be. I have some ideas kicking around. Mm-hmm. But I just feel like I don't want to be just another mental health comic because there's lots of them out there now. And I want to be a comic that talks back to mental health ideas as opposed to being another depression memoir, another mm-hmm. schizophrenia, you know. But I also want to just do something else.
Can you kind of explain a little bit about the psychology aspect, like Asylum Squad, the young ones?
Okay, the young ones? Okay, for that act?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so do you want me to talk about the plot?
Yes,
okay.
Both if you can.
Okay, so first there was Asylum Squad Monster Hospital, which is sort of like a combination of Girl Interrupted and The Breakfast Club, and that was when Liz Madder goes into the mental health.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she goes into the mental hospital because she'd had a suicide attempt because she's been tormented by a horse demon named Armin Instantinu.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is she ends up forming a clique with a bunch of mental patients in the hospital. And then they end up joining and getting accepted into this union-based drug treatment trial program called the Agnia Project. And that is the segue into the Young Ones Act. Mm-hmm. And the Young Ones is kind of like they get taken into the sort of experimental union treatment program where they go into their sleep, their dreams as superheroes and fight their demons of their subconscious as heroes. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like got elements of like Scott Pilgrim, Sailor Moon, Inception, and all this crazy shit. Yeah.
So Asylum Squad is not basically about you, more influenced by your experience.
Yes, right? There are elements of the character's experience that may or may not be based on things. And I don't really talk about it too much because I like my privacy. Mm-hmm. So a lot of it's invented. A lot of it is fiction. And it is basically fiction based on things I've experienced and based on the message that I feel I want to give to the world.
Mm-hmm. So how did you come about making comics?
Well, when I was young, I actually used to make comics, like really, really primitive comics. Like I had characters like a cat and a dog. This was when I was 8, okay. Scratch and Sniff, a dog and cat friend mm-hmm. and then Super Husky because I had a pet husky dog. Okay. That and just really kind of like basic ideas like that. But I always like to write and I always like to draw, so comics felt like the perfect medium to combine the two of them. Mm-hmm. It also is a way, I also was fascinated by film and animation, and I thought, well, that's a way of doing it on a budget. You can make a film on paper with comics. Mm-hmm. Because it's sort of the same kind of idea as telling a story. It's like storyboarding for film. So mm-hmm. that's why.
Have you ever thought about what life would be like if you didn't create Asylum Squad and didn't share it?
I think I'd be a lot more bored. I think I would less opportunity would have opened up for me. I would have met less people, would have had less interesting opportunities, and I think it would have been more of a challenge to get myself back on track with my life. So it's sort of like the thing that kind of got me back going again. It's saved me in a way.
So what kind of experience due to you creating Asylum Squad have you been able to access? Has there been any like fans from all over the world that have talked to you?
I have fans from everywhere, from the United States to Germany to South Africa to Australia to Finland, you know, like all over the place. And I mean, people send me mail all the time just wanting to tell me they like it and stuff. Mm-hmm. And generally the attitude has been very positive that I have received from my work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So overall, how has Asylum Squad affected you? Has it been therapeutic?
Yeah, I'd say it's been very therapeutic. I mean, it's my way of sort of saying how I feel when everyone kept telling me that I had a disease and I was never going to make amount to anything. And I was sort of like, oh, yeah. And I mean, it's not like I'm totally loaded or anything like that. But it is me being able to express myself. And I do have a kind of a cult fan base now, which is something I'm amazed that kind of happened. And it's just exciting to see what might come in the future. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You, during your process of trying to understand the system, like you said before, how was that process? Like, how difficult was it for you to understand how it works? Would you kind of say you're an advocate of Mad Pride?
I am definitely an advocate of Mad Pride. I'm not really the most active advocate of Mad Pride. I have been on and off, but I am heavily involved, at least with my art. I designed the Mad Pride Toronto logo, and it's actually gone overseas and been adopted in other communities like Mad Pride Paris, Mad Pride Derbyshire, Mad Pride Netherlands have also adopted logos based on the design I came up with. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like I have some kind of Mad Pride status, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. You, so seeing how the system works here, has it opened your eyes to realizing how systems all over the world differ from you? Is there any other mental health care system somewhere else that you wish that the Toronto government could adopt?
Oddly enough, I've heard good things about the British mental health care system, at least in some respects. I don't know all about it, but I know that they have the Hearing Voices Network was started there. At least that's the home base as far as I know. And the Hearing Voices Network is a group of doctors, former patients, current patients, anyone who hears voices. Mm-hmm. And they sort of are talking back to the idea that if you hear voices, you're pathologically ill and that you have to be medicated and that you are, you know, they're talking about it. They approach it from the idea that it's not the hearing the voices that's the problem. It's how you cope with them. Mm-hmm. And it's not, it's not necessarily something wrong with the brain. It could be anything. And it could be your way of coping. And that's the new psychology that's coming out. And I know that that's something from Britain. So that's kind of cool.
So being your experience at CAMH, were there certain staff that really helped you go through that?
Yeah, there were good staff. I'm not going to slam CAMH entirely. I just think that it's just the structure of the way systems are in this part of the world, especially in other parts of the world, too. Obviously, some places are worse. But I did have some really nice nurses, and there were good people that worked there. And I know one psychologist who works at CAMH who I'm quite fond of and stuff. So it really is sort of just what the system does to staff. I think a lot of people go in and they expect change and they expect to make change, and then they find that they are as institutionalized as the patients themselves, mm-hmm. because they no longer they run up against walls in their ability to make change, and so mm-hmm. they end up either getting burnt out or just changing their attitude. Or some of them will still be fighters, but yeah. a lot of them, I think that's what happens.
Earlier on, you were talking about language that you would rather use than mental illnesses. Do you have what do you feel, or how do you feel when it comes to certain people that tell you that you're mentally ill or go through?
Because my experiences are not an illness, they're transformative, mm-hmm. and that's why. Sorry, they're transformative. They're not disease, and that's why I can't identify with illness. I've transformed from this. I mm-hmm. haven't gotten sick. I mean, it's been hell, but mm-hmm. but I haven't been ill. That's what spiritual emergency is about. It's not about being sick. It's mm-hmm. about transforming, and that's why I don't identify as mental illness. But people who do, and that's fine. I'm not saying mental illness doesn't exist. I'm just saying we have to rethink how we approach it. And so I use the term mad, by the way, because it's a spectrum term, and it sort of describes people. Well, it's sort of like an umbrella term for anybody who's been psychiatrized or who has been mm-hmm. labeled mad or has had unusual experiences with psyche. And I have had those, but they have been transformative as opposed to detrimental in the grand scheme of things.
Mm-hmm. As you said before, that Asylum Squad's based on your experiences. Are mm-hmm. there any other people's experience that you've also incorporated?
Not really. I mean, yes, I mean, the tone that I'm getting from other people, but nothing directly, like no real information. I'm not taking people's stories and exploiting them or anything like that.
So do you have anything else you would like to say?
Just that if you can check out my comic at asylumsquad.ca. You can follow me on Twitter at @asylum_squad or at Facebook at Asylum Squad. Thank you.
So that's all the time we have for our show. Thank you so much for our guest, Seraphin, for joining us.
No problem.
Don't forget to check out, as she said, her Asylum Squad at www.asylumsquad.ca. Come back next week at the same time and place for another edition of Catch the Flavor Youth Radio here on Radio Region. Stay tuned, because coming up next is Murphy Brown, which you don't want to miss, right after our musical break.